You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Like it or not, we live in a digital age. Every day we're surrounded by computers and tablets and smartphones. And soon we'll probably be wearing interactive glasses from Google. But is all this technology making our lives better?
Joining us now is Clive Thompson, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Wired. His new book is Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. By the way, he'll be presenting at the Wisconsin Book Festival Friday, October 18th at 5:30. Clive, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Good to be here. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you open your book with some anecdotes about the intersection of our brains and technology and chess. We had Garry Kasparov, the famous chess player, against the Deep Blue computer, leading to kind of an us versus them mentality. That's kind of a starting point in your book and how it isn't necessarily us against the machine. Talk about why you started there.
Well, you know, I got very interested in this question of Deep Blue as kind of a metaphor for what's happening to us. Because, so, Garry Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue, and a lot of people said, well, this is terrible. This is the moment when humans are no longer relevant because machines are better at us than chess. But what Kasparov did after that was very, very interesting. He said, well, okay, maybe a machine is better at doing this brute force sort of reasoning, you know, like going seven moves out, you see every possible play, and you can beat a human that way. He said, well, rather than compete with the computer, why don't I collaborate with it? And he invented a form of chess called advanced chess, where it would be playing with one team, a person and a computer, versus a person and a computer. So the human could essentially use all the smarts of a computer to play even more complicated chess than they could ever do on their own, you know? And this is exactly what happened. People started playing advanced chess, and they began to produce these chess games that were so fascinating and creative and brilliant that they could never have done on their own. The computer couldn't have done it on their own. The human couldn't have done it on their own. But together, they could do remarkable things. And that's a sort of I regard that as a great metaphor for all the stuff that we're doing online these days.
We'll return to that theme through as we talk now, but there's a sense, there's a lot of messages out there and articles and books even, relying on technology makes us more shallow thinkers. Relying on technology, outsourcing our thinking is making us dumber in the short version. Is that a real common sentiment out there, do you think?
You know, I think I definitely hear it a lot. You know, people know that I write about technology, and so they'll ask me, they're like, wow, I'm really worried that I'm getting stupider because I'm not remembering things, or, you know, I'm not becoming shallow because I'm writing all these tweets. And I think some of that is innate, you know, sort of, and I think healthy concerns about change. And there's also been an awful lot of sort of very worried op-ed pieces and books lately, you know, things like Nicholas Carr's The Shallows, which worried about the fact that we don't have any time for contemplation, or Sherry Turkle's book Alone Together, which was concerned that, you know, we don't actually spend any time with each other anymore. So there's definitely been a sort of a concerned cultural conversation that I think has impacted a lot of people who come up to me with those worries.
You wrote that if we asked you this question 20 years ago, you would have said, "Yeah, no, this is bad for us." What turned you around in the last couple decades?
Well, it's true. 20 years ago, when I first went online, I was a bit of a nerd, so I was early into this in the early 90s. I thought, I was a bit of a misanthrope too, I think. and I thought, wow, this is terrible. The average person isn't very smart, and they're going to go online and will say stupid things, and it's going to drown out all the intelligent people, and this is bad for society. But what happened is that I'm a reporter, you know, I'm a magazine reporter, so I would be just working. I was interested in this area, and I wanted to know what people would actually do when they had the ability to communicate online, to communicate publicly to other people, to talk. And so I was constantly writing stories about, you know, instant messaging came along, and I would talk to people and watch what they were doing with it. And other tools came along, and I kept on discovering that my gloomiest concerns were not really coming true. A little bit, you know. Obviously, there's a lot of silly things people say online, but I was failing to predict the really amazing things that started happening when people were able to, en masse, think and talk and write in public and with each other. I completely didn't see things like mass collaborations like Wikipedia, or the way that you get these hilarious things, you know, people taking, you know, Amazon review threads and hijacking them for political satire, you know, or even the rise of a high level of literacy in photography and video, the way we're now seeing people becoming really elegant communicators in these modes that were never before possible. I didn't see that coming, and so that has made me much more optimistic over time.
One concern I've seen is that in the old days, we relied on our own brains. We couldn't just look something up online, so we had to think it through. We had to have discipline in remembering facts and remembering the things we need to know to get through a day. Now it's at the touch of a button for us, or a click of a mouse, I suppose. Our brains aren't exercising. They're getting flabby because we're not doing this. Do you buy that?
I used to. I used to worry about that deeply because I thought that I discovered that I couldn't really remember any phone numbers anymore. You know, they were all in my phone, and I thought, well, this is a metaphor for the fact that I can't remember anything anymore. But the truth is, when you look at the history of how we have managed our knowledge, you know, it used to be 2,000 or 3,000 years ago before writing became common that it really was all in your head. You know, you had to remember everything, and so when writing came along, you know, Socrates was very upset by this. And in the Phaedrus, which is this terrific dialogue, he said he warned about the arrival of writing. He said that knowledge that's written down will not be in men's souls. It will not be anything we actually know. It won't be true wisdom. He was, and in a way, he was sort of right. Once you write things down, you don't need to memorize them anymore. But he failed to foresee that when you can write things down, when you can store them outside of you, you can consult with a far wider range of ideas and information than ever before possible, and you can have new forms of ideas, you know, and that's what we built libraries for. What's happening now with Google is something in some respects is even weirder. We're using tools like Google or Evernote or our smartphones when we're pinging them for little bits of information. We're actually behaving the way we do with other people. This is called transactive memory. It's the fact that when you're around someone who you know and trust, you start realizing what they're good at remembering, and you sort of don't bother remembering it. You know that they'll know it. And if you're in a long-term relationship with someone, you've probably seen this. I and my wife will be arguing, you know, like, you know, how come you can't remember where the keys to the car are? You know, and she's yelling at me, how come you can't remember this? Well, it's because each of us knows the other person is in charge of doing that. We trust each other, and we're close to each other, and so we're constantly talking to each other for social memory. And social memory is a very, very big deal. It's part of what makes us smarter when we're in groups of people. We're just adapting now to bring in all these devices we have around us into these age-old habits that we've used for centuries to make us smarter.
We had Edward Glaser, author of Triumph of the City, on this network a while back, talking about the benefit of the city is that it brings smart people together to share ideas. Do you see the internet as expanding the city beyond any geographical boundaries and bringing people together and having that kind of collision of ideas?
Yes, I think that's exactly it. The thing about cities is that, in one sense, they're a real hassle to live in because they're cramped, and there's noise and interruptions, and you know, we know that on a physiological level it stresses you out. But because we're so close to all those people, there's enormous creativity. You run into people and ideas that you wouldn't know existed. So it's a trade-off. We're willing to endure all the hassles of living in cities because of the creative and cognitive advantages. And it's very similar with what we're experiencing now as life moves online. We're uncomfortable with all these hassles, the fact that there's something, it can be overwhelming and it can be distracting to be constantly in touch with other people's thoughts. And we're having to learn how to sort of take time to screen those things out. But the upside of being connected to other folks and being able to eavesdrop on what they're thinking about, to throw questions out into the ether and get answers, it's just like being in a city. It ratchets up our creativity and our intelligence. And so we're finding our balance point with that.
Another concern, and you write about it in your book, is that we're interacting with people on a superficial level if we're on social media, say, and it doesn't count. We're just sitting at home. I think you mentioned the Alone Together book earlier. Are we opting out of real important social connections when we just communicate online?
I don't think so, actually. Every piece of evidence I've seen shows that people that are very promiscuous users of communications tools online, like texting or like instant messaging or whatnot, are also most likely to hang out with their friends face-to-face. Or to put it the other way, they're just very social people. And so when they're doing all that online socializing, it's a supplement to the offline socializing. I think there definitely are, you know, rare limit cases where people substitute online interaction from face-to-face interaction. But by and large, every time anyone has tried to look closely at these correlations, they find that promiscuous online social contact correlates really strongly to hanging out with your friends. And it sort of makes sense when you think about it, because, I mean, I'm sitting here, you know, I occasionally use, you know, something like one of those location-based tools like Foursquare that shows where people are. And, you know, I'll be sitting at home or I'll be out, and every once in a while, it doesn't happen often, but I'll get a ping and I'll notice that someone is actually nearby in my neighborhood, and it's someone I haven't seen for a while. And so I'll go, well, I'll text them, why don't we get together and hang out? This is a wonderful serendipitous discovery. I mean, the fact that you can become more aware of other people has many powerful mechanisms for increasing social contact for people that want it.
We're talking with Clive Thompson about how the internet age is changing the way we think. He says for the better. We want to know what you think. Has technology made a positive difference in your life? Or do you think all this technology is causing us to maybe get a little dumber? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Clive Thompson about the ways technology is changing our minds, he says in many ways, for the better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you worry that relying on the internet, going online too much, makes us less smart, or do you think it's a great tool that that makes us more effective, that helps us think more creatively? Ashley on Facebook writes, I believe that while we may have access to more information to make us possibly more intelligent, the many outlets of technology have put our brains on overload. Our brain no longer has quiet time, no time to process the day's events. What do you think, Clive?
Well, I absolutely agree that it is incredibly important to carve out time and regular time to be away from these connecting devices. Because, I mean, if you sort of grant the force of what I'm arguing here, which is that these new tools allow us to think in interesting new ways, so do the old ones, right? I mean, like, you know, Twitter helps you think conversationally. Sitting down with a book helps you think in a very slow-moving, deep, immersive way. And it's really important to still maintain a lot of those old habits of thought, almost on like a kind of a diversity level, like, you know, like plant, like crop rotation on to keeping a farm fecund. So I've found that a lot of the most astute users of technology have sort of they pick a sort of a Sabbath period almost when they're off every week, you know, and partly inspired by them, I do that myself. I generally stay away from email on the weekends. I also generally, not completely, but generally stay away from social media. I don't check that stuff. And it's kind of nice to not be looking at a glowing screen for a long period of time every week. It really does help your brain move in those usefully different patterns. So I think they're absolutely right.
Well, the glowing screen in front of me tells me we have some callers. We'll go to Jason in Madison now. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What do you think about this?
So, not so much social media I wanted to comment on, but just generally the internet. 15 years ago, I had a rare leukemia. There are only 600 cases diagnosed annually in the United States. And I spent countless nights till 2 or 3 in the morning every night till every entry of hairy cell leukemia in Google turned purple, as you know, after you've looked at it. And I found a clinical trial in Washington and a physician that administered it, and I know I never would have found it without the internet, and I'm now cured of the cancer. And it really comes down to the fact that I found this trial online.
Jason, well, I'm glad you found that, and I'm glad you're okay. That's a heck of a story. Clive, I've read about this, people finding medical treatment, also finding support groups and researchers using the internet to pull together people who suffer from rare diseases like Jason's. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I've had some conversations with medical researchers about this, and I think early on, you know, 10 years ago, there was this understandable and legitimate fear that if, as patients, we went online, and I've certainly done it too, that we would encounter such a trove of stuff that would either befuddle us, or you'd wind up in one of these situations where you're in the discussion group where everyone's sort of peddling quack theories. You know, in reality, what doctors have found is that it's generally been better than that. People turn out to be slightly better consumers of health information than we would have hoped, such that now a lot of doctors tell me. I mean, I had a doctor who told me last year after diagnosis, he handed me the sheet and said, you know, just go Google this and read about it, basically. there's one definitely has to be, you know, careful, as I'm sure that gentleman was, that we know what we're looking at. But when your health is on the line, people can often be extremely aggressive, persistent, and critical thinkers.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jason. We've got Corey in Madison with us now. Hi there, Corey.
Hi. Just more of a comment than anything. Earlier you had talked about the technology, you know, bringing, not being a replacement for social interaction or activity, but it also kind of brings people together, you know, for the reasons you mentioned. But I guess my comment is that when I see folks, you know, getting together, they're all just sitting there looking at their phones or their internet appliances, and they're not really interacting or doing anything other than they're in proximity to each other.
Thanks. And that's a common critique, that we're at an event, we're seeing something interesting, and we're looking at our phones. Clive, do you think that's a problem? Is that a concern?
If, to the extent that it happens, anytime that happens, that's absolutely a concern. And I think that, like, there's definitely in certain communities and for certain people a sense of reaching a crisis point with that. I mean, that's what I think some of that concern is what people have tapped into when they've been worried about this. I think there's a fair amount of evidence from anthropologists and sociologists I talk to who go around and literally look at people's interactions. They say that they think a lot of people are starting to pull back from that over staring at screens moment. This happens frequently. Every time a new technology comes along, we get very excited by it. We get very obsessed with it. And eventually we realize that we're behaving kind of not very well to each other, and we pull back. Mobile phones had this period where in the 90s, when they first came along, if you answered it, no matter when it rang, you know, breakfast, dinner table, in church, in your temple. And then it took about 10 years and a lot of mocking and poking fun at people for doing that. But eventually people stopped doing that. And now you actually rarely see it happen. I think the same curve, accompanied by social censure and mocking, which I think is good, is starting to happen with social media overuse right now. I regard that as actually very healthy to sort of poke fun at people for doing that.
Some people worry about the impact on kids in particular, being too attached to devices, too much screen time, that sort of thing. Is that something that that you looked into in the book?
I don't look into it terribly closely, but I have definitely read about it and talked to a lot of pediatricians about it. I mean, by and large, it's a bad idea for kids to spend a huge amount of time staring at screens for all sorts of reasons. There's eye strain. There's the fact that ergonomically your body shouldn't be doing that. And we had the same problem with TV, you know, generations before. I don't think there's anything inherently problematic, though, with a limited and sort of judicious use of screens to do the amazing things that the internet can do. Because, you know, a lot of teachers have found, for example, that you have real trouble getting kids to write. You know, you need them to practice writing. They don't want to do it. It's boring. They're only writing for their teacher. But if you set up like a class blog and say, okay, we are now writing for the entire world, and other people start coming by and commenting on what the kids have written, you get this unbelievable sense of audience. It's so powerful, and the kids begin writing like mad, you know? So that's an example of using a computer in a way that taps into the amazing connective power that actually produces this really, really good educational outcome. You don't want the kid parked in front of the screen all day long, but there are amazing ways to use them if you use them with a good critical mind.
Jordan is with us now in Black River Falls. Jordan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
With what was actually just brought up was actually very interesting, but what I had called about was I just got back from studying abroad and I had made tons of friends and I'm a very social person, and social media has been a great outlet for me to keep in touch with my friends that I've made from all across the world. But unlike my brother, who is a little less social than me, I feel like there's also the negative impact where you can kind of use it more as a crutch instead of a tool and kind of live online like that. But which was interesting with which was just brought up about the blogging. I'm in a social media public relations course, and this past week we were required to get a Twitter and a blog to blog, and we have to do journal entries and things like that. And I feel like I didn't want to adapt into one of those online communities because I feel like that's something that you do get this general audience, and like a group of friends that you would hang out outside of the web socially, you do kind of want to keep up with that audience as well. It does kind of keep you online.
Gotcha. Well, thanks for the call. Talk about that. He's trying to use this as a tool and not, like he says, some people do, as a crutch. Can you wrap
sure.
us up, Clive, by talking about that for a few?
Sure. I mean, I think when people use it really well and not as a crutch, when they use social media to stay in contact with friends, when it's done really well, they get the experience of what's called ambient awareness, which is the fact that if you're able to sort of notice just, you know, at the corner of your eye as you follow their tweets, their pictures, their utterances, all, you know, over a period of weeks and months and years, you can develop this fantastic mental model, this deep intellectual emotional model of what's going on with your friends who you can't see. I'm Canadian. I only get to Canada about once a year, but I have this very rich, textured sense of what all my friends are doing because we have this exchange. I think when it's used well, used mindfully and intelligently, that is a new experience that a lot of people are finding is incredibly rich for the way that they know what's going on in the lives of people they care about.
Clive, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Clive Thompson, author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better.
Coming up, two men in Appleton openly carried rifles and handguns near a farmer's market and the police responded. We'll get your reactions. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.